I don't know whether you might have, whether you're a regular watcher of 60 Minutes or not on CBS. I will watch it from time to time, and I was watching it a couple of weeks ago. And they had an interview with an individual who was a former Russian spy. This individual was an East German who was recruited, like around 18 or 20, sometime about that age, spent several years of extensive training on how to be an American. And then with false papers, he was inserted into this country, and his instructions were simply to just fit in with the American way of life, get the training you need, try to get jobs in government that will eventually lead you into a position where you'll be have sensitive information available to you. So he was supposed to infiltrate the government in some unspecified fashion in hoping of getting information to pass on to the Russians. Well, it didn't work out that quite that way for him. He never had much success in finding his way into a situation where he had any information to pass on. And so years went by, and then the Cold War was over. And so he just kind of figured, well, that's the end of that. And he just settled down to the American way of life. But somewhere along the way, some defected spy said, yeah, there's an undercover agent here that's been here for years. And the FBI was eventually able to track him down and arrested him. But after after interrogating him and coming to the conclusion, well, he never really spied on anything, but he did have some good information to pass on about the Russians and how they operate spy networks and things like that. And so they worked out an agreement where he was allowed to stay in this country. Because he did give them the U.S. some valuable information there. But during this interview, the interviewer said, well, tell us about how the Russians saw the United States. And what did they fear most about the United States was basically the question that was asked. And he kind of smiled and said, they feared Ronald Reagan. They were afraid he might push the button. That's the way he described it. But it goes back to what I was talking about in the last sermon, which is part one of a second sermon I'm giving today about war and how war has driven civilization for the last 5,000-6,000 years. And this is a good example, you know, the Cold War, so forth, the big fear that somebody was going to push the button. You know, you could ask people in this country back in that time, what was the big fear? That the Russians would push the button. You know, so we have these kinds of things that have gone on forever, seemingly forever, but now we have the weapons to actually destroy the world. So, what I want to do today is first just a very brief review of what I covered in the last sermon, because during that last sermon, I basically looked at the history of war going back to around the 3rd century B.C., and that's when secular records first began to show that there were wars between states or between significant political entities. Up until this time, the secular record basically shows farmers, hunters, small tribes, skirmishes maybe you might say from time to time, but no indication of wars, concerns about wars. It was more about survival up until that time. And then we went through a lot of the developments that took place down to around 600 B.C., which was the time that Judah and Jerusalem fell. And so the course of time a lot happened in terms of the development of war, and we talked about that. And really, from a period of about 26 to 2700 years, humankind went from a relatively benign societies, hunters, farmers, to societies that were constantly at war. And I described a lot of the developments of that time, the war weapons and tactics of societies, which started out as something like bows, arrows, spears with bronze tips, and advanced to walled and fortified cities, and then from foot soldiers with shields and spears and bows, and then to chariots with a bowman and driver, and then advanced to iron. Bronze was too soft. Iron was much stronger as a war weapon, which led to iron swords, shields, and body armor, and then to horsemen with spears and bows, and to siege machines, and then total destruction warfare by the time we got down to the fall of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. So that's what I outlined last time. And so the question is, where are we now? What has happened since that time? And the first 20 minutes here or so, I want to give a review of the history of war from the fall of Jerusalem to now. And it's kind of interesting that we are now about 2,700 years from the fall of Jerusalem. And that's kind of like it's a pivotal point in terms of warfare leading up to the fall of Jerusalem. Now we're roughly 2,700 years past that time. And so how's war changed over the last 2,700 years? That's what we want to look at the first part of the sermon today. And, of course, we're here to observe the Feast of Trumpets, which talks about an end-time war to end all wars, so to speak, and the return of Jesus Christ to establish his kingdom. And so it's good to look at how we got to the point we are now, and then what God says through the Bible of where warfare is going before the return of Jesus Christ. So let's start with the rise and fall of the ancient empires. And we'll zip through this quickly. I've talked about some of these topics, and maybe one or two of these slides you've seen before in previous sermons where we talked about the rise of the beast powers that are described in the Bible. But 626 B.C., the Babylonian Empire arose under Nebuchadnezzar, the first beast power, and that was the armies of Nebuchadnezzar that were responsible for the conquest of Judah and the fall of Jerusalem. So that was around, but at least it rose around 626. Jerusalem fell in around 586. But along about this same time, around the 600s B.C., the Greek city-states arose. Leading states, Athens, Sparta. But we had things happening all around the Middle East. The Greek city-states arose. Of course, the Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom didn't last very long. And so under Cyrus the Great, the Persian Empire rose up around 560 B.C., and the Bible describes that as the second beast power. And it conquered all the Middle East, all the way over into India, and ruled there. And it almost took Greece, but the Greece city-states united long enough to stop the Persian advance right up on the doorstep of Greece. The Persian kingdom lasted for a pretty good while. It gradually weakened over time, and then the Greeks grew more powerful. In 336 B.C., Alexander the Great began his conquest of the Persian Empire. And that empire again expanded out from Greece, again, all the way out to India, a huge empire during that time. But his empire didn't last very long. That was the third beast power described in the Bible. Then in 325 B.C., Alexandria dies. The empire is split four ways. You know, one thing I forgot to get was the pointer. Laura, maybe you can have someone bring that up to me. But the Bible describes this split up of this third beast power and into four kingdoms. One was down in Egypt, one was Greece, one is in the Asia Minor area, and then the largest of those was the Seleucid Empire, which covered a large part of the Middle East and on into parts of India. Ah, thank you. Now, once this split up occurred, there were lots of wars between Egypt, between the Seleucids. The kingdoms gradually weakened. By the time we get down to around 250 B.C., the Parthians, and I talked about the tribes of the steppes. The steppes are those northern kingdoms ranging from the Caspian Sea all the way over to the Pacific Ocean through China, the different steppes people. And the Parthians were some of those from the north that came down and took over a good part of what Persia was. And there was something that historians refer to as the Silk Road. And the Silk Road was the trade routes, not just one, but the several, many trade routes that went between Europe all the way to China. And the Parthians controlled part of that Silk Road. In the meantime, around 220 B.C., China was being unified under the Qin Dynasty, and they cooperated with the Parthians and controlled the trade between China and Europe. But then, around 200 B.C., Rome defeats Carthage and begins the rise of the Roman Empire. And, of course, here we see the rise of the fourth beast that's described in the Bible. Now, during this period, from the fall of Jerusalem around 600 to this vicinity of around 200 B.C., not much had changed in terms of warfare. Not many advancements. Advancements were relatively minor, not really any significantly new weapons, maybe improvements in some of the weapons they had, better manufacturing techniques occurred. But basically, things remained relatively unchanged, other than more and more use of iron as opposed to bronze was about the only change. And so then we come to the Roman Empire and, of course, the formation of the church after Jesus Christ's preaching and then death and resurrection occurred during the pretty much the height of the Roman Empire at that time. So the Roman Empire ruled a good part of Europe, the Middle East, Northern Africa, and is described again in the Bible as the fourth beast. So we saw the rise of Christianity, the Church of God, and it's interesting the early church taught against war, and we get a sample of that from Jesus Christ himself when he was being betrayed and taken prisoner. Peter pulls out a sword, chops off the servant of the high priest, and then Christ won't, I won't show the scripture, I'll just read it to you here, Matthew 26, verses 52 and 53. Then Jesus said to him, "Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword." You know, so he said, yeah, you don't need war. You don't need the sword. You have something better. And so he established that principle there because his servants, they thought, hey, you came back to fight. And he said, no, I didn't. And you don't either. So put up your sword. And then he said, do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? Yeah, that was the... he said, look, I can do this anytime I want. But we're going to go another way. We're going to have another approach. Of course, the apostles at that time had no idea it was going to be thousands of years before Christ came, return. Now, the true church kind of disappeared by the end of the first century A.D. The true church from history just kind of disappeared from history. It was out there, but history little notes it, no longer remembers it. And a false Christianity arose. And this false church was not against war at all. As a matter of fact, as the this false Christianity rose up, centered in Rome, it became intimately linked with the Roman Empire, allied with the rulers. We had popes that had their own armies at different times. During that period, the monks became a paramilitary organization. You know, so Christians went to war. Now, it's kind of interesting that the church at that time taught that a war was not necessarily a sin. If it was a good war, if the Pope blessed it, then war was not a sin. But soldiers killing an enemy, it was still considered a sin. And that was the kind of the teaching at that time. It makes perfect sense, right? But here's the thing. If a soldier killed somebody, they had the opportunity to repent of that murder. And the Pope had the authority to take some of the excess virtues of previous dead saints and transfer that to the repentant soldier. So he was not only forgiven of his sins, but he did not have to spend much time in purgatory and could move right on to heaven. So that's kind of how that was handled back in that day, which I found was kind of interesting to read about that. But, you know, the true church, as I said, pretty much disappeared from history. You have to really look hard to find little indications. Yeah, they were there, but history did not note them. And so things moved along until 476 A.D. when the Western Empire fell. The cause of the fall of the Roman Empire were many, but the forces that produced the fall were the steppes people. They were called barbarians in history. They weren't necessarily that any more barbarian than the Romans and other nations, but they were referred to that way. They weren't as organized as a society. They were a nomadic people. As we mentioned last time, their lands were the pasture lands. The steppes were basically the flat pasture lands from the Caspian Sea all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And that's where they roamed and fed off the grasslands and so forth. And they were very much a warlike people. And so they invaded the Roman Empire. And so during that time, we had in succession the rise of the occupation forces that invaded the Roman Empire. Three kingdoms rose up. And from Bible prophecy, we know that from that Roman Empire, there's going to be 10 kingdoms that rise up. Three of those kingdoms were steppe kingdoms, different barbarian tribes that ruled the area of the Western Roman Empire. And 554 A.D., Western Roman Empire was restored under Justinian, which represented the fourth king that was to rise back up. And while these things were going on in the European area, the Muslim empire was growing. It kind of reached its zenith around 750 A.D. It controlled all the Middle East, the North Africa moved on in and basically had taken over almost all of Spain. And that advance into Europe was finally stopped around 750 B.C. I think it was the Battle of Tours that finally defeated the Muslim advance, and they gradually retreated after that. And then I think it was Charlemagne's father or grandfather that stopped the advance at Tours. But by 800 A.D., Charlemagne was crowned as the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire by the Pope. And there you see basically that most of Europe was what was controlled in this coalition of, in this case, France and the Catholic Church, headed by the Pope. A little bit later on, Otto the Great was crowned the Holy Roman Empire. It's kind of this kind of flashing, showing the different expansions and contraction of the Holy Roman Empire through the Middle Ages. So this began about 960. And then the Seventh Kingdom, the Habsburgs, controlled much of Central Europe at the time. From the 1400s to the early 1800s, Seventh Kingdom. And then the city-states of Italy formed a nation around the 1800s. Excuse me, I'm getting ahead of myself. In the early 1800s, France rose up to control, dominate most of Europe and much of the Middle East through Napoleon. And so there was the Eighth Empire. And then the ninth one, finally, the Italians united. The Axis, the Germany rose to power, and eventually, ending in 1945, the Italian and Axis powers ruled most of Europe for that period of time. It's the Ninth Kingdom. We haven't seen the Tenth Kingdom yet, but there's one more to arise. So that kind of takes us through the governments during the period up to modern times. But let's go back and look at war. That was what was going on in terms of war and weapons during that time. The Middle Ages, which is generally dated from about 500 to 1500 A.D., let's look at some of the aspects of that. Basically, during this entire period of time, there wasn't really any great advances in weapons. There were improvements, but the advances were relatively limited. Cast iron swords, crossbows, stirrups, siege engines. Stirrups was a big advance because it enabled a horseman to better control himself when he's firing, whether it's a spear or a bow and arrow or whatever. Armies developed bowmen on horseback with great skills during that time. A little later, cast steel rather than iron was a better material for swords and spears and armor. And so we saw more development of armor. But, you know, these are relatively minor things. The age of the armored horseman was basically the main weapon of war during the Middle Ages. The historians refer to a bowline that separated the East from West. And in the West, the horseman's primary weapon was the lance, whereas in the East, the primary weapon was the composite bow. But it was just weapons of choice at that time. Feudalism was the term that's used to just basically describe political organization at that time, which is kind of going back to the tribe era, our city-state era. There were these various local lords that controlled certain areas and had the big castle that basically served as a defense that people could come to in times of attack. And these local city-states, leaders of those, had loyalty to a king that ruled a larger area, but there was a lot of decentralization all during the Middle Ages. So the rise of the various empires that we were talking about were much more loose, you might say, than back in the days of the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire and so forth. Now, of course, one of the big things about war during the Middle Ages were the Crusades, which ranged from around 1100 to 1400 A.D. And it was more than just the Christians against the Muslims. There were other religious wars going on during that period of time, but the ones that we note the most is the Crusades, where the Christians were trying to get control of the Holy Land and Jerusalem. And this went back and forth for centuries, that battle. But there are also Muslim rivalries. We see those rivalries still today. The Shia, which believe that the ancestors of Muhammad should be ruling Muslims, whereas the Sunni were followers of a different clan that believed that that clan should take on the reins of authority. And that kind of battle has been going on ever since. One note of history where the True Church does show up is in around 1179, the Waldensians appeared. And the Waldensians were Sabbath keepers. They rejected the Pope and the Catholic Church. They rejected war. And this is probably why they appeared in history, because obviously they were persecuted. They survived for a number of centuries, but were, by the 1700s, they were pretty much disappeared, pretty much annihilated, absorbed, so forth. But there was a period in there where we see true Christian beliefs being expressed. Now, meanwhile, in the steppes, the Mongolian Empire ran from the Eastern Europe all the way to the Pacific Ocean. You know, this nice world view. All that purple area there is basically the Mongolian Empire's. You hear from history of Kublai Khan and Genghis Khan and various ones. They control that area and, of course, control the Silk Road at the same time and control trade. So they arose up from the early parts of the Middle Ages. But then we have something that changed the history of war: gunpowder. Now, interestingly enough, it didn't change anything at first. Gunpowder is an explosive mixture of charcoal, sulfur, and potassium nitrate. And the problem with gunpowder is this: the potassium nitrate is hard to come by. It comes from saltpeter, which is found in caves, but it's difficult to obtain. But it was in the 11th century that it was first produced. Gunpowder was first produced in China. By the 13th century, rockets were being propelled by gunpowder. By the 14th century, rudimentary cannons had been developed. Like I said, during this period of time, it was not world transforming, and the basic problems had to do with it was difficult to make. Even more, it couldn't be stored. It would not last long. It would not stay together and last long, so it couldn't be stored. And so the cannons and rockets to use it had to be small and not very accurate. And it was a volatile material, so it was dangerous to use one of those weapons. So it was more of a novelty than rather than used in war. But that changed in 1429. And this occurred in Europe when a process for making gunpowder called corning was developed. course, the world would never be the same after this. Now, what Corning involved was basically moistening the powder, the same mixtures we were talking about, moistening that powder with wine or vinegar or some other solvent, drying it out, and then crumbling it up, and it crumbles up into tiny spheres. In that state, it could be stored indefinitely. It could be detonated more efficiently. It could propel projectiles further, more accurate. And so now all of a sudden, gunpowder could be used. And along about this time, the Harquebus rifle was developed. This was a pretty big development, and really the rifle hasn't changed a whole lot since. The idea, you have the long barrel, and then the handle is bent down, the butt is bent down, so it fits in the shoulder so you can lean and aim down the barrel of the rifle. And really, rifle have not changed a lot since that in terms of their shape. But these first ones, you had to load it up one shot at a time, you know, the old Revolutionary War, the dropping in the powder, the pellet, so forth, and cramming it down and so forth, then firing a shot, you know. So it was a slow process initially, but it was a significant improvement, and perhaps even more so, it led to the development of better cannons that could propel. And these cannons basically made castles obsolete. And, you could use cannons and knock down the walls of castles. And soon these cannons were placed on wheels so they could be transported. And perhaps the one of the biggest developments of the era was they were placed on ships. And so ships became deadly weapons of war. And so this period of time, between the 14th and 18th century, gunpowder changed everything. The area of the 14th to 18th century, often referred to as the Renaissance, but it's also a period of military revolution. Europe became the world's leading military power by far, far outstripping the rest of the world. Religious wars were almost constantly going on in Europe at that time. Protestant Reformation occurred, and it was not some peaceful thing, but brought on many religious conflicts as a result of that. Military culture grew. Military life became a culture in itself. Large standing armies were often used by countries during this period of time. There were global wars to control trade. And this, when you think about how Europe outstripped the rest of the world during this period of time, is when you look at the empires that formed, all for the sake of global trade. The galleon here, a picture of a British galleon, these mighty warships, that's how you control trade. You built up huge navies. And so the most famous of the empires during that period of time is the British Empire, which at its height controlled the east coast of North America, most of Canada, India, parts of Africa, Australia. Considered the greatest empire during that period of time. But there were others. The French Empire. The French were very active in North America until they were driven out by the British. But they also controlled a good portion of West Africa, certain parts of Indochina. So they had a world empire also. The Portuguese, Portugal was a little dot on the map almost, but they controlled a good part of the eastern part of South America and parts of Southern Africa. And then, of course, there was the Spanish Empire, which controlled the western side of South America, a good part of the Western United States and the and their empire. They had all these empires competing against each other, large navies, so great naval battles during that time. But war was almost constant, and you know, alliances changed from one to the other, and things were just happening all over the place. Then we come into the 19th century. This is when war became industrialized. We had the rise of the arms industry, imperialism, steam-powered ships. That was a big advance over sail. Steel-hulled ships, railroads to truth movements. You know, railroads became very important to war during this time. Communications improved. Now you could actually communicate across large areas in fighting. And we begin to see some technological advances like the machine gun, the breech-loading rifle, the cannon, the ship cannons improved, increasing the firepower dramatically and accurately. You know, instead of having to stop and ram another load into the barrel of a gun, now you just cock it and another bullet goes in. And so things got to the point where the killing power greatly increased during that time. Then we come to the 20th century, which we could call a century of war. Of course, race, nationalism, religion all played a part in that. In Matthew 24:7, we see this prophesized for nation. And the word nation there is the Greek word. Ethos is ethnic group. So nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, with the Greek word for kingdom there, basically government entities. And so the Bible was predicting that this is what was going to happen. You know, firearms, artillery changed relatively little during this system. There were improvements, but basically firearms and so forth did not change a whole lot. But there was a big change, the internal combustion engine. You know, so we look at these major changes, gunpowder, the internal combustion engine. You know, all these things were great changes. Then we come to World War I. The use of lethal chemical warfare was developed after the war. Of course, the League of Nations was formed. It didn't keep the peace. There were about 10 million military deaths during World War I. So it was a very deadly war. And civilian deaths were very large. You know, all-out war, as opposed to wars between armies, became popular. Trench warfare, where basically fighting for years over just a few miles of land and the slaughter of millions of soldiers. And towards the end of the war, two things would develop. One was the aircraft. It began to play a role towards the end of the war. Tanks also began to play a role. But air power was the big thing. Really the first new advance since gunpowder, you might say, was the airplane. And then we come to World War II. Peace did not last very long. We saw more advances, radar, landmines, tanks, submarines, torpedoes, aircraft dominated many aspects of war. Battleship was made obsolete by aircraft. various types of government, fascism, socialism, communism, democracies were all battling each other. The United States Nations was formed after World War II. Hasn't led to peace. Now, after World War II, up to the present, then we saw the development of jet aircraft, large bombers, helicopter gunships, wireless communications, guerrilla warfare and terrorism, and weapons in space, and of course, the big one, nuclear weapons. The atomic bomb has only been released twice in warfare, with Nagasaki and Hiroshima to end World War II. I think sometimes we forget just how powerful these weapons are. You know, we look at the results of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and how it was wiped out. But I found this to be an interesting graph here. You may not be able to read it all, but this is a bar graph of the power of different atomic weapons that have been developed. And see right down here, this little circle? That's been blown up here. And here's the Hiroshima bomb. And it was about a 15 kiloton bomb. And right after World War II, this was the test. The Trinity was just a test. And it got up to around 20 kilotons. But very rapidly, those weapons increased in their power. And so here are those bombs. Mike, one of those bombs, got up to 10 megatons. You know, this is 10 million tons as opposed to 15,000 tons here. And then up to 15 megatons. Now, the biggest one of all is called the Tsar bomb that the Russians developed. 50 megatons, 50 million pounds. So that's what we're facing. Now, here's another graph that I found interesting. If you can't quite read this, this is 5 million, 10 million. So this is a scale of millions of deaths here, starting at around 1400, going up to the present. And you can see there's three big ones here. One you never would have thought about, the Qing Dynasty versus the Ming Dynasty, a civil war in China, where around 25 million were killed. Of course, World War II is the biggest, 60 million were killed. down here, this was a steppes ruler who was consolidating the Mongol Empire, attempting to. Around 7 million were killed. But then we move over here into the last couple hundred years where World War II occurred. Let me go to a slide that blows this area up a little bit. Here's that civil war in China. But you can see, and we're talking about 5 million, 10 million, 15 million, 20 million, and so forth. You see the World War I, but the Sino-Japanese war was killed even more, the rebellion in China. You look at some of the things you know a little bit, Napoleonic Wars, the Chinese Civil War, the Russian Civil War at the end of World War II. But you see there's been a collection of major wars with lots and lots of deaths, almost unimaginable deaths. And that's where we are now, around 27 years past the fall of Jerusalem. We can literally destroy the world. Now, interesting enough, since about 1989, by historical standards, we haven't had a lot of war. They've been relative in terms of deaths and major armies and so forth. It's been kind of a sustained period of, minor wars. Which reminds me of Matthew 24, verse 42, where Christ, in talking about the end times, said, "Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming." That's going to be a surprise. I mean, things are settling down a little bit, there's going to be some shock there. In Isaiah 59, verse 8, Isaiah was inspired to write, "Indeed, the way of peace they have not known. There is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall not know peace." And that prophecy has certainly been fulfilled. And so now we come to the end time, the day of the Lord. And I want to take us through the battles that will happen at that time. And let's begin with Joel. Joel chapter 3, verse 9. You might say the initial warning is coming. "Proclaim this among the nations, prepare for war, wake up the mighty men, let all the people of war draw near, let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, 'I am strong.' Assemble and come, all you nations, and gather together all around. Cause your mighty ones to go down there, O Lord." Okay, so we're talking about the gathering of nations here. in Joel 3, verse 12, continuing on, "Let the nations be awakened and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, go down, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision." So, the Bible prophesizes that there will be an end time war. You might call it World War III, if you wish. But where will it culminate? It will culminate in the vicinity of the Middle East, and specifically in the area of Israel. Now, let's go over to Revelation. You know, if we let me go back just a second here to one thing. If we look at overall Revelation, there's the seven seals, the seven trumps, and then the seven last plagues or bowls. But if we go back, those first four seals describe basically the history of the world up until the end time. And the fifth seal related to the Great Tribulation. The sixth seal is cosmic disturbances. And then that seventh seal is the day of the Lord. And then the first four trumpets that sound bring on a series of cosmic disasters. And so that brings us then to the fifth trumpet. And at this point, everybody is ready for war, but the big one hasn't broken out yet. So Revelation 9 and verse 1, "Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star falling from heaven to earth, and to him was given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened because the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given the power as scorpions of the earth to have power." All right, so we see several things here. First of all, the angel comes down. It says a star came down. We won't turn there, but Revelation 1, verse 20, the Bible refers to the angels as stars. And so it's likely we're talking about an angel from God who comes down and he opens the bottomless pit. Now, the implication here is up to this point, this power has been restrained and has not, and God has prevented it from rising up. And at this point, the restraints are removed. Now, of course, what is that power? What is the source of that power that's going to arise up? You know, the armies are described as locusts, but look at Revelation 17:8. "The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And those who dwell in the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life." So the beast power is what's being restrained. The last resurrection, you might say, of the Roman Empire. And so that's what's going to come out of the bottomless pit. Now, you know, who gives the beast this power? It can be a little bit confusing when you read this, because it looks like God saying, "This is my army, and I'm releasing it," and read some of the prophecies and so forth. But look back at Jeremiah 27, verses 6 and 7. Because here, this prophecy is talking specifically about Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylon kingdom. And notice what he says, "And now I've given all these lands to the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant. And the beasts of the field have also given to serve him, and the nations will serve him," and so forth. But notice he calls Nebuchadnezzar my servant. Now, was Nebuchadnezzar, in terms we think of as being a servant, ever God's servant? Now, he was serving himself. Now, God made his power known to him, and really Nebuchadnezzar had a chance to turn and serve God. But he never did, on purpose. But unbeknownst to him, causing the fall of Jerusalem was serving God. That was part of God's plan. And so, people serve God when they don't know they're serving God, is the point here. You know, and basically everything and everybody serves God, whether they know it or not, because God's working out a plan. You know, it's God who gives power and limits. Remember what God said to Satan in early in Job? He said, you can afflict him, but you can't kill him. God sets the limits on everything. And so that's what's happening here, going back to Revelation 9 and verse 4, going back to these locusts that were released. God sets the limits, and now he's removing some of these limits. And they were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So this is obviously a war between, you might say, a war between heathens. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and it will flee from them. All right, so God is restraining the killing at this point. Now, So this locust army, you might say, well, is it some kind of non-lethal poison gas that might be described here? Where's this army moving towards? We'll look at that in just a minute. Who are they fighting? Could this be some sort of nuclear radiation that's causing this problem? We don't know. But let's continue on in verse 7 of Revelation 9. And the shape of the locusts were like horses prepared for battle, and on their heads were crowns of something like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men, and they had breastplates like the breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. They had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men for 5 months, and they had as a king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name was in Hebrew Abaddon, which means destruction, but in Greek he had the name of Apollyon, which means destroyer. This is obviously referring to Satan. But notice God is the one that's in control. God is controlling here. Now this is John trying to describe modern warfare. How do you describe modern warfare when you've never seen a gun? You've never seen a bullet? You've never seen a bomb? You've never even thought about something that could fly through the air and fight? How do you describe that like John was trying to do back around 2,000 years ago? Yeah. And this, you know, power to hurt people would not kill them for 5 months. Nuclear fallout. Now think about this. Suppose you were living 100 years ago. Let's go back. You're now living in 1915. You read this scripture. How would you interpret it? Would you interpret it as huge flying machines? Aircraft had just been invented a few years before. The weapons. How would you interpret it just 100 years ago? You'd probably see this scripture very different from today. We look at it today, and what do we see? You know, we see maybe helicopter warships. We see nuclear radiation. We see lots of things that no one going back even 100 years would be able to describe with any kind of accuracy. And maybe we're not seeing it yet, because more weapons may be on the way. You know, remember what Mr. Sanderland said the other week in his sermon? He said, a prophecy is not fully understood until after it happens. They say, oh yeah, now I see what he meant. You know, but as we get closer and closer, we begin to see more and more. You know, what is he trying to describe? Is he trying to describe helicopter gunships with faces on them? They exist these days. Here's one with the face of a bird, feathers. But here's one of these massive, heavily armed gunships these days. Now, suppose this thing was flying around and you tried to describe it. In the first century, weapons coming out in all directions, how in the world would you begin to even take it in as to what it was if you were living 2,000 years ago? That's what John was trying to describe then. All right, let's go to Daniel 11, verse 40. You know, who was this resurrected beast that we see fighting in Revelation 9? And at the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him, and the king of the north shall come up against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the country, overwhelm them, pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But there shall be, but these shall escape from his hand: Edom, Moab, the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. So here, what we see at the time of the end: a northern army, well, an army of the south, is going to come up and attack, and the army of the north, these powers described as the army of the north, is going to come down and capture Jerusalem and defeat the army of the south. Right now, we say it sounds like probably Muslim armies. No. But a war breaks out. A war breaks out between armies from the Middle East, armies from Europe. Now, continuing on in Daniel 11, verse 43, he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans, the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels, but the news from the east and north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many, and he shall plant his tents and of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountains. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So here he is. This army has moved into the Middle East. This army from Europe has moved into the Middle East. But there's problems going on here. News from the east and the north trouble him. From the land of the steppes, China, Russia. Now go back to Revelation 9 and pick up in verse 13. Now the sixth angel. So we have this war going on. The sixth angel sounds, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, "Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates." And so the four angels who had been prepared for this hour, this day, this month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. And the number of the horsemen was 200 million. And I heard the number of them. Okay, so now we have the sixth trumpet. These angels release an army from the east. That army was restrained up to that point. Now it's released. And we have this attack from an eastern empire. China, Russia, Muslim allies. We're not sure exactly what that's describing at this point, but it's a massive army. It kind of sounds like China, doesn't it, in terms of the size of it. But look at the description of the attack. "And thus I saw the horses in the vision. Those who sat on them had breastplates of fiery red, hyacinth blue, sulfur yellow, and the heads of the horses were like the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and brimstone. By these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed, by the fire and the smoke and the brimstone which came out of their mouths, for their power is in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents having heads, and with them they do harm." All right, so we have this massive attack describing three types of weapons, as best John could at that time: fire, smoke, and brimstone. You know, so it sounds like, rockets, bombs, smoke, poison gas maybe. But the main thing here is we're talking all-out war. How do we know that? By the death toll. A third of mankind. A third of mankind. So this war is not just in the Middle East, but it's all over. But it's centered on the Middle East. A third of mankind. Zephaniah 3 and verse 8. Therefore wait for me, says the Lord, until the day I rise up for plunder. My determination is to gather the nations to my assembly of kingdoms, to pour on them my indignation, all my fierce anger. All the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. See, God said, that's my plan. This is what I am going to allow to happen. All these armies are going to be assembled there. Joel 2 and verse 20. But I will remove far from you the northern army, and will drive him away into a barren and desolate land, with his face towards the eastern sea and his back towards the western sea. His stench will come up, and his foul odor will rise, because he has done monstrous things. If we go back and look at the whole chapter 2 of Joel, starting with verse 1, and we start reading through there, you know how it starts out? Blow the horn, let Zion hear. Now God's day is now at hand. We used to sing that hymn. It's an old hymnal, but it's not in our new hymnal. You ever thought about that? Right in the new hymnal. Well, when you read through the context of the first 10 or 15 verses of Joel, what it's describing is this beast army moving in to destroy Judah. Is that something you really want to be all happy and singing about? Now, I don't know why it's not in the new hymnal, but I suspect that may have something to do with it. But that's describing, the first part is describing Nebuchadnezzar's invading of Judah and the destruction of Jerusalem. But then by the time you get to verse 20, things have changed. It's talking something broader to come in the future. And so when we read Joel 20, that's talking about a future event. That's not talking about back in 586 B.C. And right as we read on further past verse 20, we'd see it's talking about the land will be restored, the people will be brought back to Israel. You know, so obviously it's talking about the end time in context. Now, but this northern army is going to be destroyed. Revelation 16 and verse 1, then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the bowls of the wrath of God on earth. So now we're at the seventh trumpet. The seventh trumpet sounds, and there are these bowls, these last plagues, so to speak. And these happen very quickly. That first one that's poured out creates loathsome sores. The second and third ones turn the water to blood, of all the water, the seas, salt, fresh. The fourth one, the sun scorches the earth. And the fifth one, there's darkness. And see, these are all basically supernatural events. But the armies are there. And they don't know what's happening. You know, and then we come to the sixth one. The Euphrates is dried up. In Revelation 16:12, then the sixth angel pours out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its army was dry, and its water was dried up, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. Now we've already seen one wave of attacks from the east. There's going to be another wave coming in. So one wave with China, with the other waves be the steppes people, Russia. But we've got armies coming in from the east. Two different occasions here as things wind up here. In Revelation 19 and verse 11, now the seventh trump, the seventh bowl occurs. Then I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes wars. His eyes were as like the flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no one knew except himself. He was clothed with a robe dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, followed him on white horses. Now, what we see here is Christ finally making himself known. You know, he's personally leading this army. Why? Now, why not just keep sending the angels? He did that many times in the past. Remember the time in Hezekiah's time? All those Assyrians were invading. Yeah, they just fell over dead. You know, or like Sodom and Gomorrah's time. You know, just bring down the fire and brimstone, kill them all, end of it. Now, Christ was identifying himself, and he wanted the entire world to see. Now, that's and that's another thing. How would the world, entire world, see this before now? You know, we used to say, I know, back in the 60s when I first came to church, I'd say, oh, yeah, television. But television wasn't good. No, everybody didn't have televisions. But everybody has a cell phone. You know, from the remotest, deepest, dark, primitive nations of Africa or wherever, everybody has cell phones. Everybody can follow what's going on. I think we're getting closer. Let's continue on in verse 15 here of Revelation 19. Now out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, and that with it he should strike the nations, and he himself will rule them with a rod of iron. He himself treads the winepress of the fierceness of his of wrath of the Almighty God. He has on his robe and on his thighs a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. You know, so it happens. It finally happens. The seventh bowl of the seventh trump, Christ returns. Revelation 1 and verse 7, behold, he is coming with clouds, and every eye will see him, and they also who pierced him, and all the tribes of the earth will mourn because of him. Even so, amen. They are going to want to fight. Now, he comes, they want to fight. Acts 1, verses 10 and 11. And while they behold steadfastly towards the heaven as he went up, referring to Christ after the resurrection, behold, two men stood by them in white apparel, who also said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing up in heaven? This same Jesus, who was taken up from you into heaven, will so come in like manner as you saw him go into heaven. So he's coming back, and people are going to see Jesus Christ himself, and they will fight him. And then we come to the seventh bowl that's poured out. The seventh angel poured out his bowl into the air. A loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, It is done. And there were noises and thunderings and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such a mighty and great earthquake as has not occurred since men were on the earth. The great city was divided into three parts. The cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. So what is Christ doing? He's collapsing the world. Not just Jerusalem. Not just the Middle East. All the great cities fall. There's a definition of world war. This is it. And all the men of war are gathered there. But it's the whole world that is crumbling. And Jesus Christ becomes. Finally, God's true power is going to be revealed. Revelation 16, verse 20. Then every island fled away. The mountains were not found. A great hail from heaven fell upon men, every hailstone being the weight of a talent. Men blasphemed God because of the plague of the hail, since the plague was exceedingly great. They don't get it. Zechariah 14, verse 1 describes this. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst, for I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against these nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall split in two from east and west, making a very large valley. Now, that's the way it's going to happen. Christ is going to actually come down. And if he's going to stand on that mountain, he might appear fairly large in size, you would think. You know, this is not the just a simple human being in that form, but something very, very different. In Revelation 19:27, then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of the heavens, come and gather together for the supper of the great God, that ye may eat of the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses and those who sit upon them, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great. You know, it's going to be a huge, huge, unheard of, unthinkable slaughter, death, and destruction. The earth itself and upheaval. And then it's over. It's over. No more bombs. No more guns. No more fighting over religion. No more jihad. No more refugees desperately trying to find safety in some other nation. No more fear. No more slaughter of innocents. And after 6,000 years, the end of war. After 6,000 years, peace. True peace throughout the land. Now, this is what we're... You know, we come before God on the Feast of Trumpets, and we kind of think in terms of just war, battle. But that's not the part we're really celebrating. What we're celebrating is Christ returns and what he brings with that return. He brings peace. We're celebrating the end of the last great war. We're not celebrating the last great war. We're celebrating the end of that war, but more than that, the end of war. Peace at last. Peace at last. Thank God Almighty. Peace at last.